The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You're listening to Red Leg Nation Radio, the official podcast of redlegnation.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to yet another edition of the Red Leg Nation Radio podcast. I'm your host, Chad Dotson, redlegnation.com. Thanks for joining us again today. I've got a fun program for you, I think, lined up today. Our buddy Joel Luckup, he's known as Slide over at everyone's favorite Reds blog, redreporter.com. More interestingly than that, he's one of the co-authors of a very, very interesting new book. And this has been sort of a fantastic time for Reds books the last few months, and we'll talk about that a little bit. But I want to welcome Joel to the podcast tonight. How are you doing today, Joel?
Good. Thanks for having me on, Chad.
I appreciate you coming on. We've been trying to actually get this planned for a while, and I keep failing to follow up on it. We're glad to get you in here, and it's a good reason to do is talk about this book, The Wire-to-Wire Reds, Sweet Lou, Nasty Boys, and the Wild Run to a World Championship. This is about, what, the 1998 Reds?
1990 Reds.
Oh, 1990. Oh, okay.
Yeah,
oh,
that's the 1998 Reds were just short of the Wire-to-Wire Championship.
Just missed it.
That's the next book, by the way.
Oh, I didn't mean to let the cat out of the bag. I'm sorry about that.
Well, it's going
to
be just like a little kid's book. It'll only be like 3 or 4 pages.
Yeah, maybe a coloring book. That'll work.
Yeah.
So you wrote this book with John Arardi, who's written several, a number of great Reds books. Tell us how sort of the concept arose and how you all started this project.
Well, you know, some of you may know that, John and I have collaborated together previously on articles that he's published in The Inquirer, and that's actually been going on for a couple years, along with Justin J-N-A-Z, or however you want to pronounce it, and Greg Gages, who's been around on the blogs a little. All three of us have kind of helped John at various points whenever he wanted to do something sabermetrically slanted in The Inquirer, which has been very well received and worked out great for us and for him as well. So the relationship kind of developed through that. And then last summer, I was at a book signing with him. He was doing a book signing for his book, Crosley Field, that he wrote with Greg Rhodes. And I just went over and was talking to him, and I was like, well, what are you going to work on next? And he said, I don't know. And I said, well, nobody's ever done a book about the 1990 team. And he said, yeah, you're right, nobody has. And that was kind of that, and I kind of took that as him being, yeah, maybe. So, about August, I'm feeling really burnt out in my job and trying to figure out what I want to do when I grow up. And my wife says to me, well, why don't you write a book? And I said, well, I don't know if I could do that. And then I started thinking about it, and the idea was still planted in my head of, there wasn't a book about the 1990 team. And, growing up at that time, it was really, that was my team. I say in the book, the Big Red Machine is kind of a tall tale that I've only heard about. I wasn't alive when the Big Red Machine was in their prime. So, the 1990 team was kind of my championship team. So, I thought about it for a while, and then eventually ended up talking to John and told him that, hey, I'm thinking about quitting my job and writing a book about the 1990 Reds. What do you think? And he said, well, I think it'd be good because there hasn't been a book about this team. Of course, the funny thing with John is you can tell him the same idea a month later, and he'll act like he's never heard the idea before. The flip side of that is he may very well tell you the same idea and act as if he came up with it himself. He's very good at taking your ideas and making them his own. And I say that in the most loving way possible.
Certainly.
So anyway, he said, yeah, I think you should go for it. I think it'd be a good book to do. Nobody's done one before. A few weeks later, he emailed me and said, you know what, I really like the idea about a book about the 1990 team, especially with next year being the 20th anniversary, and I think, I'd love to be able to do one, and I think it'd be great if we worked on one together. And, you know, one thing led to another, and the next thing I knew, I actually had somebody who knew what they were doing working on the book with me, which was ended up being a huge help.
Yeah, outstanding, and obviously John been a part of several Fantastic Reds projects, and this was sort of a natural, as you said, because of the 20-year anniversary. Now, for some context, and you talk about this some in the book, and you just mentioned it a moment ago, and I wanted to sort of go back to it. We're kind of the same way. I'm a couple years older than you, but we were too young to remember the Big Red Machine, really. We grew up sort of surrounded by the memories of the Big Red Machine from everyone around us, but really this 1990 team is the one that people sort of our age and that generation, it is. I like the way you described it. It's our team. That's the most fun I can remember. I was in high school at the time, and what an incredible season that was. So I like that we've got sort of documented now our team, and it's
right.
First time that's happened.
Right, and that was one of the goals that John and I set out with, was to kind of get this team out of the shadow of the Big Red Machine. I don't think people ever really appreciated how good this team was, or, you know, how interesting they were and how fun they were. And I think part of that is that, and this may be the legacy of Reds teams for a few more generations, but anytime you have a good Reds team, you always start calling them the Big Red Machine. Well, you know, there's only one Big Red Machine. There's never going to be another Reds team that's as good as that team, at least probably not in our lifetime. It's hard to get your own identity as a Reds team anymore, especially if you're good, because you're already being labeled as this Big Red Machine. So that was kind of our goal, is to say, you know, look, this is the team's identity. This is not the Big Red Machine. This is a different team.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a team with their own distinct identity. And while they may not have had the Hall of Famers that the Big Red Machine had, there was no shortage of interesting personalities and great stories out of the 1990 team. And you guys have touched on a bunch of those in this book.
Right. And Todd Benzinger gave us a quote that I think is really kind of describes why this book needed to happen. And that was, you know, reading a book about the Big Red Machine winning world championships isn't that interesting because they were supposed to win world championships. Reading a book about a team, he said, I'd like to read a book about either a team that was supposed to win that didn't and figuring out why, or reading about a team that wasn't supposed to win that did. And that's kind of who this team was. You know, they were kind of getting to that reputation of, well, this team can't win. And it's interesting to me how they went from, you know, this team that couldn't get over the hump, finished second 4 years in a row, then they had the whole Pete Rose fiasco in 1989, and then how they became, you know, this cohesive unit and really won as a team in the true sense of the word.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. It's a much more interesting story, a much more interesting narrative, and from beginning to end, just the way all of it coalesced in that fantastic season. You know, late summer, early fall, had a chance to speak with both Joe Posnanski and Mark Frost, who wrote books that one of them was specifically about the Big Red Machine. The other was about the 1975 World Series Game 6. And, you know, I had a blast reading those books, talking to those guys. But, you know, still, I don't remember those things these books were about. I don't remember the games and the players as well. And this team right here, I can remember Luis Quiñones and Tim Leana and Scott Scudder just as well as the Larkins and the Davises. It was a fun team, just top to bottom.
Right, exactly, and I hope that some of that comes out in the book too, because you know there weren't many guys on this team that didn't have an interesting story going for them. There weren't these superstars and then the turds as they were on the 1975 team. You know, it was everybody contributed at some point. Everybody kind of has their own story for that year and you know their moment in the year, and that was one of the fun things about telling the story, was that you didn't find yourself talking about the same guys over and over and over. You know, it gave us a lot of opportunity. I mean, we featured Norm Charlton quite a bit, and I don't think people, you know, think back to that team and think, wow, Norm Charlton, you know, he was kind of the heart of that team. But in many ways, he was, and he was very exemplary of the team because he went from being very successful in the bullpen to taking on a starting role that he didn't particularly want, you know, but he took on this role and was successful as a starter too.
And you know, not only that, doing what it took for the team, but running over Mike Socia at the home plate, and then the whole incident with the Phillies where he nailed Von Hayes with a pitch, and that later on in the season, the bench clearing brawl sort of coalesced the team maybe a little bit. I think that was, you focused on a guy like Norm Charlton, and all these guys you focused on, several of them, but he's one of them that, you're right, most people really may not know as much about Norm Charlton as you should for a team like this. Everybody knows about the Joe Morgans and the Johnny Benches and the Pete Roses. I think you guys were spot on when you look at this team. You get a lot of different things that you can talk about that people just maybe not have known or have forgotten.
Right, and it helped that John was in the clubhouse at the time then. He wasn't the beat reporter, but he did a lot of coverage of the team. It was funny to go back and look at the clippings from the Inquirer because I joke with John that he must have been Joe Morgan's shadow that year for about 2 months because Morgan went into the Hall of Fame, and every story written in the Inquirer was by John Arardi about Joe Morgan. And it was, you know, Dateline Cincinnati or Dateline Oakland or Dateline Cooperstown. You know, he was all over the country following Joe Morgan all around, but somehow he still was in the dugout or the clubhouse enough with this team to really have his finger on the pulse of what was going on. I mean, he was telling some of these guys, okay, I remember this and this, and they're like, yeah, I had forgotten that, and that's a great point, and all this stuff. So, you know, I was very lucky to have somebody like John to work with.
Yeah, absolutely. How much, you know, just from the fan side of it, how much fun was it to relive that season? How much did it take you back, you know, to where you were that year? And, you know, just how much fun was it just from a fan's point of view?
It was incredibly fun. It was – my memory of that season isn't as good at – well, I should say it two different ways. I thought my memory of that season wasn't as good as it ended up being. I don't have a lot of memories of specific games. But then again, on the other side, I was surprised to find that a lot of the stories that I remember from that season, or that I remember from my childhood, were from that season. You know, the Charlton barreling over Mike Socia, the Lou throwing first base, the Glenn Braggs breaking the bat over his shoulder. You know, a lot of those different events that, you know, I had just assumed were an amalgamation of like things I remembered from my childhood ended up being part of this incredible season. And, you know, that as I was like researching the book, learning that kind of stuff, I mean, I knew some of those details were, you know, the big ones were there, but learning some of the smaller ones that I had forgotten about, like Herm Winningham's three triples in a game, I had forgotten. I remembered that event, but I had forgotten that it happened in 1990. And those kinds of things, when you start, you know, seeing all of those come together in the same season, I was like, wow, I remember a lot more of this season than I thought I did. And that was kind of exciting for me, just, you know, to realize that, you know what, the season really did have such a big influence on me, more than I expected. I expected, you know, going into this, that I was going to write a book about a championship team, and I was going to talk about, you know, why they were a championship team. I didn't expect that, you know, I had so many memories from this season that I hadn't quite pinpointed as part of this season.
Well, that's, you know, just for me reading the book, that's sort of a similar reaction that I had. You know, the National League Championship Series against the Pirates, the World Series against the A's, I actually recorded those games on VHS, and they used to, even 10 years later in law school, they used to make fun of me for pulling them out every spring and watching all those games, all 10 games. But I, you know, what I enjoyed most about the book I found was reliving the regular season moments, that some of which I had remembered, some of like you I didn't realize happened actually in 1990, but that I'd recall, and some that I'd just plain forgotten. That to me was a joy. I feel like I could tell you every pitch that happened in the playoffs after reliving that so much. But the regular season and just the way it started out 9-0 and sort of a swoon in the dog days of summer and I don't know what else to say other than it was an interesting story beginning to end, and I really enjoyed, that's a credit to you guys, I really enjoyed reliving that sort of day-to-day experience that I had way back then when I was following the Reds every day and checking those box scores.
Thanks. I appreciate that sentiment because when we were laying out the outline for the book, we told the publisher, we said, we're probably not going to do a whole lot on the playoffs and the World Series. And they're like, really? And we said, well, no, because everybody knows those stories. The interesting stories happen during the season. Well, it turns out we ended up, writing a lot more in the playoffs and World Series than we expected. Felt like it was a good way to summarize some of the themes that we had touched on all year or all throughout the book. Our initial plan really was that the first half of the book was going to be all the way up to 33-12. Because that was like when they were who they were, when they were this dynamic team that was, that would run over you and, it was described as, they put their shoulder into you and then they wouldn't let up. And that really comes through in those first 45 games in the year when they were just, they were bat out of hell with the way they started the season.
Absolutely, and wire to wire. One thing you focused on at the beginning of the season and before the beginning was, and this is what I thought of when you mentioned, sort of not letting up, was Lou Piniella. The hiring of Lou, and really you got to give Piniella a lot of credit for the personality of that team and what they were able to accomplish that year.
Right. I was a little bit surprised to see how intense Lou was just on a day-to-day basis. You get this image of a fiery manager coming out on the field, throwing the base or arguing or whatever. But even behind the scenes, they would tell us stories of him coming in and, after just a simple loss, I think it's in the book that Billy Hatcher talks about, they just won a few games in a row and then lost one. And Lou comes in and tosses over the buffet table and is angry and yelling because they lost one game. And he had that intensity all year. Stan Williams, who was the pitching coach at the time, I had a quote from him that I picked out of, the Dayton Daily News or something. He talked about how they were roommates that year, and he talked about how Lou lived this team for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, nonstop. And, Lou even said, this is my last managerial stop. I'm not doing this anywhere else. This is in 1990 he's saying this. He said, I'm not doing this anywhere else. This will kill me if I keep this up. I take it home too much. And, now here we are 20 years later. He's still saying the same thing, right, at what, his fourth different managerial spot. So.
Yeah, exactly. But he was as fiery, you discover that he was as fiery as we all remembered him being, I guess.
Exactly. And, he had a lot of intensity, and there's a couple page breakout in there that, it kind of explains that it spread to the team. They were ejected, 14 times that year as a team. They had quite a reputation as being whiners to the umpires because they argued everything with the umpires. They led the league in hit by pitches that year because the other teams hated them. And it all kind of stemmed from this attitude that Lou brought to the team. They were a young team, so they were very prone to be influenced by their manager. And I think it was one thing that Pete Rose didn't bring. We got a lot of impression that, the guys liked Pete, but he was a little distracted at times and his head wasn't in the game as much as as you imagine Pete Rose being Pete Rose the player. Pete Rose the manager was a little separated. I think there was some frustration that he couldn't be out there playing and spreading his intensity that way, and so he kind of his mind wandered elsewhere. Lou brought in this focus and this accountability to his players they didn't want to let him down, and so they played with kind of that same fire that he brought to the team.
Well, it was interesting to see how the team began to be sort of shaped differently after after Rose and with Pinella coming on. I think you guys discussed that quite well in the book. Something else that I had never really thought about much with respect to that 90 team, and we all know the stories of the Big Red Machine and how they traded for Joe Morgan and the George Foster acquisition and all that, but never really thought too much about how this 1990 team was sort of cobbled together and the final pieces were put together. I guess Bob Quinn was the general manager at the time and made some moves that I think you guys talked about quite a bit in the book that in terms of how they affected the Reds, trading John Franco to get Randy Myers out in the bullpen, the midseason deal where they traded the true creature, Ron Robinson, for Glenn Braggs for the Brewers. And then, of course, you guys say in the book, Reds management kind of considered Billy Hatcher to be sort of the missing piece of the puzzle when they acquired him from Pittsburgh. Was that something you realized going into it, how much Billy Hatcher was integral, I guess, to that team? Or that
I think everybody has this memory of Billy Hatcher being so good in the World Series that they kind of assumed that he was good the whole year. And I like to joke with John. I say that, if we had blogs back then, we would have been bitching and moaning about Billy Hatcher still playing left field with Glenn Bragg sitting on the bench.
We really, really would have. There's no question about it. It'd be bad.
Yeah, I mean, because Glenn Braggs tore the cover off the ball that year. Now Hatcher hit really well the first couple months of the season, but Braggs wasn't brought in to be this big bat to put in left field. Braggs was actually brought in to be a platoon partner with Paul O'Neill, because Lou Piniella was convinced that Paul O'Neill couldn't hit lefties and wasn't ever going to figure it out. And Braggs destroyed lefties that year, and it was a move that obviously worked out very well. Billy Hatcher still, I think the thing that he brought, he didn't bring necessarily so much sabermetrically, although, he was a good defender and, so he brought some good defense, but he brought, some personality to the team, a lighthearted personality, somebody who laughed a lot, but also, somebody who had playoff experience. He had played with the Astros in the 86 playoffs, and that's kind of what they, management was looking for. I think some of the players were a little disappointed that they hadn't gotten a big bat to cover in left field, but ultimately I think Hatcher kind of earned his way onto the team, by starting off hot. He hit well, Larkin hit well, Mariano Duncan hit incredibly well to start the season, and Sabo hit really well to start the season. And I think those guys at the top of the order really set the stage for their offensive performance during the first 2 months of the season. So I think it worked out well getting somebody like Hatcher. I just don't think that, with the way that we overanalyze every move that the Reds do, we would not have been happy with the way that, with that kind of a move that the Reds had made to play left field.
Yeah, no question. In my memory, I really liked Billy Hatcher back then. Just everything about him, he seemed like he was having fun out there, and he was, he did play good defense. He ran the bases fairly well. But, I've looked back over the last few years as I've started to learn more about statistical analysis. And, really, other than sort of the traditional weak sisters of that starting lineup, Joe Oliver and then Todd Benzinger most of the time, Hatcher really was offensively about as weak as as the Reds had that year. But you're right. I don't know what it is about him, and I hesitate to say intangibles because that's not what I'm trying to say. But he did bring something to the table, and certainly the Reds evidently felt like he was the missing piece, as you guys talk about. I thought that was an interesting perspective.
Right. Well, we would have been furious with the .381 slugging percentage in left field, especially because Todd Benzinger was slugging .340 at first base.
Can you imagine a .291 on base percentage for Benzinger? Can you imagine we would just be
With Hal Morris sitting on the bench, you have a rookie who won a batting title in the minor league sitting the bench, so you can have this guy who's has a .340 slugging percentage, a .291 on base percentage to play first base. Oh, we would have been furious.
But what's great about those memories is even now I know Todd Benzinger really couldn't hit at all, but I remember him catching that ball behind first base for the last out of that World Series, and so Todd Benzinger will always have a soft spot in my heart, and that's the way a lot of Reds fans feel.
And Todd Benzinger, I think he's going to end up being a great coach. He was very articulate, very well-spoken, very intelligent. I don't know that he necessarily had good perspective on his playing career, but he seemed to have a pretty good perspective on other people's playing career. So I think he thinks he was a little better than he probably was during his career. But otherwise, I got that perspective from him that, he kind of understood other players' roles really well. So I think he's going to end up being a good coach. Hopefully he'll keep moving up through the Red system.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that, not really shifting too much because we've talked about some of the sabermetrics a little bit, but one thing that I really found interesting about the book, and you don't see this in very many books, and I imagine this is your influence, because I have read everything that you've done in the Inquirer with John, but wins above replacement, batting average on balls in play, a lot of sort of the newfangled stats show up in this book. Was that, I don't know, how well received was that, and how open was John to that?
John wanted it. I think that's why John wanted to do the book with me, because he wanted to do something that was a hybrid. It's kind of weird. When we initially set out to do this book, it was more going to be a coffee table book. But the more we researched into it, we're like, wow, there's really a good story to tell here. This needs to be more of a detailed story. But we had always planned, even way back at the beginning, we'd always planned to do these little analysis breakouts where, we look at how this team was successful, why they were who they were, beyond just, the regular platitudes that you throw at a team. Oh, they were a great team, or they were a great, they are great at situational hitting. We wanted to break it down a little further. I hope that people still, we tried to do it in a fashion that it wasn't just where it wasn't over people's heads. We wanted to make sure that it was Joe Average, who doesn't read about baseball. I mean, a lot of these concepts are very familiar to people who read a lot of blogs and such, but Joe Average, who doesn't read on the blogs, may not be familiar with a lot of these concepts. So we wanted to try to do it in a fashion where it was still made sense, and I hope it comes through that way. But John was in full support of it, and he actually really wanted to go with that aspect, and have that in the book. He thought that would add something that, you don't normally get, out of a baseball book like this.
Oh, I thought it was a wise decision, and I think that it's more subtle than I maybe implied a moment ago. You're not beating people over the head with this stuff. You're introducing some of these concepts and talking about how you can evaluate this team using, for example, wins above replacement. But it's a it's a book that even Joe Fan, who doesn't care anything more about anything than batting average, home runs, and RBIs, is going to be able to dig right into and absolutely love. It's I don't want to give the impression that it's sort of a sabermetric type book. It's not, but there's sort of subtly some of those concepts weaved in there, and I appreciate you guys doing that because it gives us a different perspective than we're used to about this team.
Right. And, it is definitely, in fact, I'm sure there's plenty of flaws in there that true saberists are going to be like, oh, this is terrible, I can't believe we're talking about this. But, we didn't want to do a full on sabermetric, baseball perspectives type book. We wanted to do something that was a little more of a hybrid
and more accessible. And I think that was a good idea. Whether you look at it, through the sabermetric stats or the traditional stats, the Nasty Boys were good, weren't they?
Oh, they were awesome. There's a what we call a fast fact in there that says something like they were the first bullpen to have three guys pitch at least 50 innings and strike out 10 batters per 9 innings. And I think that says it all right there. They came into the game and, it was and they were striking them out, and, just like that. They were in many ways the identity of this team. They were that attitude, personified. What's somewhat funny about it is multiple people told us, Myers was just kind of kooky, that he wasn't really this, it was kind of this persona that he had put out there, that Dibble was kind of a fake, you know, that he wasn't as tough as he made himself out to be, and that Charlton was the one that you did not want to mess with. You know, they say that, you know, you want to stay away from the quiet ones, because if they're not talking, that means that they're stewing. And Charlton was definitely the quiet one of the three. Also the most intelligent one of the three, but, you know, that's not necessarily saying a lot.
not a high bar to cross, but, yeah, of course, Charlton had a triple major, I believe, from Rice University, if I remember, correctly, but I was happy that in looking back at the Nasty Boys, that the memory of how dominant they were was not diminished in the least by, any analysis of them in retrospect. You got the game to the sixth inning and it was over, and you don't see that, very often.
No, not, especially not anymore. Not with, you know, in many ways, going away from that Nasty Boy model is probably diminished bullpens, strictly because, you know, these guys used to pitch, they would regularly pitch two innings each. I mean, not in the same game, obviously, but any one of them would pitch two innings when they came in. Nowadays, you've got such specialization, thanks Tony La Russa, that I think you end up seeing more lower quality pitchers come into games, because, you know, you're using more pitchers. Back then, you know, Lou Piniella, he had his three guys, and he rode those horses hard. Now, Tim Liana also pitched quite a few innings. He wasn't as effective, but he was. They still considered him one of the Nasty Boys. In fact, he wasn't put on the playoff roster, and, you know, all three of those guys were writing Liana's number on their sock or on their hat or whatever to pay tribute to him. So even though those three guys kind of got all the press, they still, you know, considered Liana to be one of them. And actually, they considered the whole bullpen to be part of the Nasty Boys, even though they weren't all getting the press that those three guys were.
All right. In the formation of the Nasty Boys, you know, well, putting Liana on the – grabbing him in the Rule 5 draft was one interesting, I guess, transaction. But when you look at the Randy Myers – the Reds took a little bit of heat, didn't they, for because they traded John Franco for him, and John Franco had been outstanding for several years.
Yeah, John Franco, I think, had won the Roll Eights Relief Man Award in 1989 or 88. It's probably 88. And, you know, a lot of his teammates at the time of the deal were very upset that he had been dealt. They all felt like it was strictly a financial deal. Myers was, I think, going to make about a third of what Franco made. And, you know, given that both of them were left-handers and that Franco had much more success, you know, a lot of them just said, you know, look, this is just a financial deal. And I think really there were two reasons why Bob Quinn and Lou Piniella wanted to make the deal. Number one was because Randy Myers, or they wanted somebody who was going to share the closer role with Rob Dibble. And they knew Franco would never, you know, agree to anything like that. And then the number two, they felt like Myers would do it. And number two was because they wanted to make a statement to the team, you know, look, this is our team. This isn't Pete's team anymore. This is our team. Any one of you can be sent out of here if we don't feel like you fit the mold that we are trying to build. And I think they kind of sent that message home by, you know, picking Franco. Franco was pretty close to Pete, had a lot of ties, you know, with Pete over the years. And so I think that, you know, that kind of just sent that message to them that, look, you know, this guy was entrenched here, and, you know, we're going to get rid of him. We're going to change the attitude a little bit, and this is the direction we're going. You know, get used to it, basically.
Well, it worked out, certainly, and created one of the more memorable, maybe the most memorable bullpen in baseball history. Just, I don't know. I really enjoyed reminiscing about the Nasty Boys. A lot of great, it comes to mind that there are a lot of great photos in this book, a ton of pictures. The Reds, I guess, were pretty cooperative with you guys because, is that right?
Yeah, well, we got a bunch of pictures from the Inquirer. So that was helpful, and some of the, you know, the best pictures in here are Inquirer pictures. And then we did also get the Reds opened up their coffers for us and let us go through and pick out, you know, basically any kind of picture we wanted to take for the book. They let us, you know, sift through everything. So we were very lucky with that. There are some absolutely amazing shots in here. A couple of them are AP photos that we had to, you know, fork out some cash for, but, the picture of Norm Charlton plowing through Mike Socha is an AP photo, but, you know, that's one of those images that you absolutely have to have in this book. So, there's some incredible pictures in here that we love. I'm very happy with the way the book looks in general, with the pictures and the layout and the coloring and all that. I'm very happy with it.
Yeah, you can tell that it would have made a fantastic coffee table book because fantastic, colorful photos, just and great subjects, I guess, photos as well. One sort of member of the family back then that really is not mentioned for various reasons as often anymore is Marge Schott. And you guys talk a lot about Marge in the book. Did you learn anything new about Marge that you didn't know, or what was, how'd you guys choose to address Marge as part of this team?
We kind of decided that we were going to just address Marge when it was relevant to the story that we were telling at the time. I think people know Marge's story pretty well. There's not a lot about Marge that we would have been able to say that people would have been like, wow, I didn't know that. The one thing that surprised me, though, was to find out that the players actually liked Marge. That was in part because Marge paid her players well. She didn't necessarily pay the rest of her staff well, and they didn't really like the fact that she was cutting scouting or, you know, doing whatever she was doing. They all thought she was a little eccentric, a little crazy, but they liked her as a person. They accepted who she was as the owner. Even Eric Davis, who is forever tied to Marge for two different incidents. One was when he lacerated his kidney, and there was some debate over who should pay to have him fly back to Cincinnati, which Davis paid for his flight originally, but Marge eventually reimbursed him. And then the other thing is when Marge used derogatory terms to describe Davis, which we don't necessarily need to get into here. But those two events kind of, you know, tied Davis to Marge, you know, probably forever. You know, when you talk about Marge Schott and the Cincinnati Reds, there's always going to be that footnote of the things she did to Eric Davis. And I found an obituary written by Davis for, well, it's not really an obituary, but it's a note written by Davis after Marge died that he sent to Sports Illustrated that they published. And he says in there, he said, you know, Marge was my friend. I considered Marge a friend. All of those things, all of those memories that people have of her, those are not the memories I have of her. And that really said something to me about, one, the relationship that Marge had with her players, and two, about what kind of a man Eric Davis is. He really was, if there was one person in this book that I felt like I learned the most about, it was Eric Davis. And that he wasn't, you know, he's not this glorified superstar that sometimes he was made out to be in the media. He is an honest to goodness gentleman and like a true person. And I hope that John and I were able to, you know, demonstrate that for Davis because he deserves it.
Well, you stole something I was getting ready to say here, so I'm just gonna plow ahead and say it anyway. But yeah, what that said to me, and I was gonna reference exactly what he said, Eric Davis said after Marge passed away. It did say something about Marge and what the players thought about her, but it absolutely said more about the class of a guy like Eric Davis. And you know, there's a point in the book where you guys mention, I guess it might have been actually from last year's fantasy camp, and Eric Davis walks in, and the guys, they all love him, you know, but there's a, sort of a reverence for him as well. He was sort of the star, but everyone loved him. I guess it's sort of a strange dichotomy, but I thought that was an interesting look into who Eric Davis is and what the people who know him best thought about him.
Yeah, you know, it was hard for me. I'm not even sure I did it justice in the book because there was just this air about him. When he first came to Fantasy Camp this year, he showed up on, you know, he showed up on like Monday night or Tuesday night after we had been there for a couple of days, and we're having kangaroo court, and nobody has seen Eric yet, although I'm sure some of the other guys, other players had seen him, but none of like the campers had seen Eric yet. And, you know, he shows up, and, you know, there's all these former major league players there. And Davis shows up, and he suddenly just becomes the center of attention. Like, you know, he's the man. I was so, like, surprised to see that these major leaguers who had been around some of the greatest players of all time just had this, you know, general respect for Davis. And you could – I think it was just because, you know, they could respect that, one, you know, he had such tremendous talent, and two, he was he had such class, you know, I don't think that he ever treated players as beneath him. I kind of got that impression from them. I mean, what really wowed me was, you know, Joe Oliver and Eric Davis acted like they were best buddies. And, you know, Joe Oliver, you know, he had a pretty good career, but it's not like he was ever a superstar. I don't think he ever went to an all-star game or anything like that. You know, and Eric Davis was this superstar, but he and Oliver were just, you know, chummy out on, you know, when we were out on the patio drinking beers, and he's out there just, you know, they're treating each other like they've been best friends for, you know, three decades or whatever. So seeing that, that glimpse of Davis, I'm not sure I could ever do it justice, even explaining it to you right now. I don't feel like I have it. There's just, it's a weird, impressive air that he has about himself. And this is coming from somebody who, you know, I idolized Davis growing up. So it was weird for me to see that that side of him, you know, really made him much more human too.
Well, anything that sort of reminds people what a great player and what a great guy Eric Davis was and is, I'm all for that. I'm glad you guys focused on that a little bit because, you know, I revered him as well growing up, but now he did take some heat, some undeserved heat at times during his career. And so I like the fact that you guys were able to sort of reflect a little bit on Eric Davis and some of the things that people should remember about Eric Davis.
Yeah, and I think his image in Cincinnati changed a lot when he came back in 1996.
Absolutely.
You know, and I think that did a whole lot for who he was, how he – or what his legacy in Cincinnati was. One thing I will say that I'm not real sure if I said this in the book or not, but somebody asked him at fantasy camp, you know, he said, Dave, Eric, how long did it take for you to get back to normal after you hurt your kidney? And he said 2.5 years. And I don't think people understood that. I think when he left for Los Angeles, when he was traded, you know, people were saying good riddance, you know, you're the shell of who you used to be. And, you know, to hear him say, you know, it took me 2.5 years before I was back to normal health-wise, I think, you know, that's something you never heard him complain about in the papers. You know, John likes to call Davis the best gamer he's ever seen. And, you know, that's saying something. And I don't think that most Reds fans have that perspective of Davis.
Yeah, and what irritates me most, I guess, about the bad rap he took was that, you know, that that injury, the lacerated kidney, you know, he in 2.5 years, whatever, that was in the line of duty. He was going all out to help the Cincinnati Reds win a world championship. And, you know, it started with Marge not paying for that flight and all that dust up, and then the bad rap he got after that. I'm glad that we can try to rehabilitate his image a little bit.
Right.
Although, at this point, maybe it doesn't need to be rehabilitated any, because you're right, opinion has changed, but this guy went all out for our team, and I think he needs to be recognized for that.
And he spent a week in the ICU. That just blows my mind. From a baseball injury, he was in the ICU for a week. It's crazy.
I know, and it always made me at the time sad, frankly, that here the Reds were having their you know, celebrations and everything, and Davis couldn't be a part of it because he was out there in the hospital, and he was still suffering. And for someone that was sort of the center of that team, maybe not the leader. We'll talk about Barry Larkin in a minute. Maybe not the only leader, I guess. But, you know, he was sort of the center and the rock and the guy who sort of, when he hit that home run off Stewart in game one, everybody credits that with being sort of the moment. And, you know, that's Listen, I'm a fully paid member of the Eric Davis family. say that.
Yeah.
What about Larkin? Did you learn anything about Larkin? He was a young guy at the time, and we know what he did after that. But he was pretty much the man at that time with that team, even despite his youth, wasn't he?
I wouldn't say that this is like Larkin's team, but it was definitely his coming of age year. He became Barry Larkin, I think, in 1990. The guy that could do it all. He could bat first, he could bat second, he could bat third. There's some good quotes of like, Larkin is playing shortstop and during the playoffs, and all Eric Davis is thinking is, hit it to his right, hit it to his left, hit it, so that he has to run backwards about Larkin, because he wanted all of the nation to see how great of a player Larkin was. He appreciated who Larkin was, and he felt like the playoffs were going to be a great time for everybody else to see that, no, it's not Ozzie Smith who's the greatest player or the best shortstop in the league. It's Barry Larkin. And I think 1990 kind of cemented him in that or maybe not cemented him, but put him down that road of becoming the best shortstop in the National League for the 90s. He played 156 games that year. A graph that we wanted to put into the book but wasn't able to, demonstrated that when Larkin played at least 80% of the games, the Reds, his team's games during his career, they were a winning team. I think they had two losing seasons in the years where he played at least 80 games, or 80% of the games. And the years where he played less than 80% of the games, they had two winning years. Did I say two losing years before? Or two winning? I don't. My brain's all scattered right now. But anyway, basically what it means is when Larkin was healthy and playing, the Reds were a winning team during his career. And that really, started coming through in 1990 when he was doing it all. He started out, hit 600 the first week and a half of the season, which, that short, it's a short, small sample size, but still nobody does that for a week.
Sure.
So he just had an incredible year that year. And it wasn't his best year. He was much better in 95 and 96, but, it was still kind of his coming out party with the nation to say, look, this guy's awesome. Start paying attention.
Yeah, absolutely. And this story always amuses me and no one else, I'm sure, but I'm going to tell it anyway. I remember that year, being in school and being outside of the school before the school day started, and some guy comes up to me, Larkin's hitting 600 or whatever, and he says to me, come on, his average has to come down. I'm thinking, yeah, probably, but, this guy's a good player. But I don't know why I still remember that from back then, but it was sort of his coming of age year, and it was the year that Larkin has ended up being he's my favorite Red of all time. And it was a year where, I think that's a good way to put it, America was sort of introduced to him into what we had been able to witness a couple years before that, but for the rest of his career.
Mm-hmm.
What a great player, and what a, that team allowed him to showcase some of his talents, fairly well, because they needed him to be that, sort of the leadoff guy when he was batting leadoff, and they needed his defense and through the anchor of the field. And so again, anything that paints Larkin in a good light, I'm all for that.
Well, it's hard when you're talking about his, him as a player. It's hard not to paint him in a good light. He was an incredible player.
Absolutely, absolutely. Is there anything? And you mentioned a couple things maybe already. But is there anything else you can think of that? And there may not be. I may be putting you on the spot here that you didn't know, or that surprised you, or the most interesting thing you uncovered as you researched this book. Anything else before we get out of here that you would like to mention about that?
There's so many good things. One thing that I hadn't really thought about was the Reds were a running team and they used their speed a lot. But on the flip side, they shut down other teams running. Joe Oliver was incredible that year. Threw out like 40, 43% or something like that of base stealers, but to start the year, he threw out like 13 of the first 20 guys that tried to steal against them, and these weren't, you know, Joe average stealers. These were like Vince Coleman and Willie McGee and Roberto Alomar, those guys. He, you know, for a rookie to come in and kind of establish this presence of, you know, you will not run on me, really impressed me about Oliver. That I hadn't expected. I always kind of just imagine Oliver being this average catcher. But you know, that he wasn't that great of a hitter his rookie year, but that wasn't his job. He wasn't there to be a hitter. He was there to, you know, control the pitching staff and shut down the running game of the other team. And he did just that. So, you know, he was one of those guys that I hadn't expected to see much out of him. So that kind of impressed me. I didn't really see that coming.
Yeah, I didn't remember that either from back then. Always thought favorably towards Oliver, even though he never really could hit that much. But I didn't realize he really controlled the game as well. That's a good point. The book is The Wire to Wire Reds, Sweet Lou, Nasty Boys, and the Wild Run to a World Championship, written by Joel Luckup, who's here with us, along with John Arardi. You guys are signing some books here soon, I believe. Is that right?
Yes, we are. We will be at the Reds Hall of Fame on Saturday, June 12th, from 4:30 to 6:30, just before the Royals game. So if you're going down to get your Scott Rowland bobblehead, or if you're going to the Reds tailgate, come on over to the Hall of Fame, and we'll sign a book for you. We'll be up in Dayton at Books & Company next Wednesday, June 19th at 7 p.m., and we'll be at Wednesday's not the 19th. Wednesday is the 16th. We'll be at Walden Books on Saturday the 19th. Walden Books on Glenway Avenue on Saturday the 19th from 1 to 3 p.m. All of these are on the sidebar at redreporter.com or at our website, wiretowirereds.com. Also has our schedule there. And if you aren't able to make it out but would still like to get an autographed book from us, you can buy one at wiretowirereds.com, and John and I will be happy to sign it for you and ship it off to you.
Well, I can't urge everyone strongly enough to go out and pick up this book, and if you can get it signed, that's a bonus, but I guarantee you're going to enjoy reminiscing the 1990 Reds with this book, The Wire to Wire Reds. Just great job on the book, and congratulations on it, and I wish you nothing but the best for the book's success.
Thank you very much. And I forgot to mention, it makes a fantastic Father's Day gift. So, you know, don't skimp out on Dad this year. Buy him the book.
You know, I had to have it as soon as I could get it. I went and ordered it. I should have thought of that, and that could have been my Father's Day gift. but definitely. Great job, Joel. Really appreciate you joining us here today. It was a good conversation. Enjoyed getting to reminisce a little bit about that. Thanks for coming on.
Well, thanks for having me on, Chad.
And, you know, we're talking about this book, but and I've been wanting to get Joel on the podcast for a while, and I've sort of slipped up, procrastinated about that. But, you know, he's a part of the fine Red Reporter community over there, redreporter.com. And I hope we can have you back on sometime soon just to talk about the current Reds and things that are going on, because this continues to be an interesting organization no matter how they're doing on the field.
Yes, that's true. I think they're moving in the right direction. Not doing so hot tonight, but, you know, they'll go get them tomorrow, hopefully.
Yeah, I agree. They're headed in the right direction, and so we'll have you back on, I hope, sometime real soon to talk about that a little bit. Well, again, Joel, appreciate it. Thanks.
Thanks, Chad.
All right. That was Joel Luckup, one of the authors, along with John Arardi of the Wire to Wire Reds. This has been the Red Leg Nation Radio Podcast. Thanks for each of you for joining us tonight, for downloading us. You have a lot of things you could be listening to, and I appreciate you listening to us. Check out the RN Radio tab at the top of redlegnation.com. Have all the previous episodes. Also have a link where you can subscribe via iTunes to the podcast. Once again, for Joel Luckup, this is Chad Dotson saying so long.